This is Audible.
Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs.
Turn the Ship Around, a true story of building leaders by breaking the rules. Written and read by David Marquet. Foreword by Stephen R. Covey. I had the opportunity to ride the USS Santa Fe during Captain Marquet's command tour and observed firsthand the impact of his leadership approach. It had a profound impact on what I thought possible in terms of empowered and engaged workplaces. I had been training U.S. Navy officers in leadership during the dot-com era when I started hearing about something really special happening on a submarine in Hawaii. When an opportunity arose to ride the Santa Fe, I jumped at it. I embarked on Captain Marquet's submarine to see what the buzz was about. Never before had I observed such empowerment. We stood on the bridge of this multi-billion-dollar nuclear submarine in the crystal-clear waters off Lahaina, Maui, moving silently along the surface of the water. Shortly after getting underway, a young officer approached the captain and said, "Sir, I intend to take the ship down 400 feet." Captain Marquet asked about the sonar contacts and bottom depth, and then instructed this young man to give us another few minutes on the bridge before carrying out his intention. Throughout the day, people approached the captain intending to do this or to do that. The captain would sometimes ask a question or two and then say, "Very well." He reserved only the tip of the iceberg type decisions for his confirmation. The great mass of the iceberg, the other 95% of the decisions, were being made without any involvement or confirmation by the captain whatsoever. Wherever I went on the submarine, the control room, the torpedo room, even the galley where they were preparing lunch, I witnessed a dispersed intensity of operations I hadn't expected. The crew was amazingly involved, and there was a constant low-level chatter of sharing information. I can't say I actually saw the captain give an order. I asked David how he achieved this turnabout. He said he wanted to empower his people as far as he possibly could within the Navy's confines, and maybe a little bit more. There was a mischievous twinkle in his eye when he told me that. He felt if he required them to own the problem and the solution to it, they would begin to view themselves as a vitally important link in the chain of command. He created a culture where those sailors had a real sense of adding value. But that answer only makes clear his objective, not what it actually takes from the top man in the organization and everyone else to accomplish this. How do you create such an organization? What does it take? The answer is in this program. What I love about this program, first of all, this is a great story, one of self-discovery, tension, and the lonely self-doubts of the leader who sets off on an unknown path. We know now that Captain Marquet's experiment on the Santa Fe was wildly successful, but at the time, neither he nor the courageous crew who embraced this new way of running an organization knew if it would work. Second, the book provides the specific mechanisms they used on the Santa Fe to achieve the transformation. We learn what they did, how the crew reacted, good or bad, and how the mechanisms matured with time. The good news is that these mechanisms are about how we interact as people and are universally applicable. You can apply them in your organization, business, school, government, and family. Third, the book presents a comprehensive paradigm shift for how we think about leadership. Captain Marquet has coined the phrase "leader, leader," to differentiate it from the leader-follower approach that traditional leadership models have espoused. I think that laying out this distinction in such opposing terms is a good idea. Having personally witnessed how the Santa Fe operated, I can attest that this new way is not a nuanced modification of how we are doing business now. It is fundamentally different, and that is where its power lies. Why you want to listen to this program? No matter where you are in your company's organization chart, you'll want to listen to this program. People at the top will learn how they can release the passion, intellect, and energy of those below them. They may be unwittingly behaving and taking actions that work against those goals. People on the front lines will also find ways to embrace decision-making and make it easier for bosses to let go of control. We are in the middle of one of the most profound shifts in human history, where the primary work of mankind is moving from the industrial age of control to the knowledge worker age of release. As Albert Einstein said, the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were when we created them. They certainly won't be solved by one person, even, and especially, the one at the top. Our world's bright future will be built by people who have discovered that leadership is the enabling art. It is the art of releasing human talent and potential. You may be able to buy a person's back with a paycheck, position, or power, or fear, but a human being's genius, passion, loyalty, and tenacious creativity are volunteered only. The world's greatest problems will be solved by passionate, unleashed volunteers. My definition of leadership is this. Leadership is communicating to people their worth and potential so clearly that they are inspired to see it in themselves. I don't know of a finer model of this kind of empowering leadership than Captain Marquez, and in the pages that follow, you will find a model for your pathway. Remember, leadership is a choice, not a position. I wish you well in your voyage. Stephen R. Covey, Spring 2012. Introduction. People are frustrated. Most of us are ready to give it our all when we start a job. We are usually full of ideas for ways to do things better. We eagerly offer our whole intellectual capacity, only to be told that it's not our job, that it's been tried before, or that we shouldn't rock the boat. Initiative is viewed with skepticism. Our suggestions are ignored. We are told to follow instructions. Our work is reduced to following a set of prescriptions. Our creativity and innovations go unappreciated. Eventually, we stop trying and just toe the line. With resignation, we get by. Too often, that's where the story of our work life ends. Even the most promising employees can go through this downward evolutionary spiral. Take Ian, for example, who should have been viewed as a model employee by the multi-billion-dollar communications company that hired him. Instead, his first corporate employment experience was so disheartening, he swore never to return. He's now an entrepreneur. When I asked Ian what went wrong, he told me, "I could complete my day's work in 2 hours. I asked for more, and I was met with, 'In time, young man.' I had no decision-making power." And this from a company that has a reputation for thoughtful leadership and innovative products. Ian quit and found a more satisfying way to spend his time. You know, sure, maybe over time things would have improved. But who wants to gamble their career? No, their life energy, on the hope of a sea change at an established, successful company. I went on to pursue my dreams, and I've done so. If you have felt the urge to follow Ian's example, you are not alone. Worker satisfaction in America is at an all-time low. Worker engagement and commitment to their employers is also at a low. As of November 2011, unemployment had been at 9% for 31 months. You'd think that everybody who had a job would be happy just to have one, but that is not the case. This deliberate disengagement is costing billions in lost productivity. Disengaged, dissatisfied, uncommitted employees erode an organization's bottom line while breaking the spirits of their colleagues. Gallup estimates that within the U.S. workforce, this cost is more than $300 billion in lost productivity alone. As large as the cost is in lost productivity, my sense is that it is dwarfed by the cost of lost joy and happiness. Bosses are frustrated as well. If you are a boss, you have likely been stymied by the lack of passion and ownership you see among your workforce. You probably have tried to encourage them to make decisions, only to have many seem more comfortable simply doing what they are told. Empowerment programs start well, but don't sustain themselves. New workers come into the organization straight from school, expecting to be given prescriptions for how to do their work. This situation exists in even the best companies. For example, Dr. Scott Mesh is CEO of Los Niños, a company dedicated to assisting with the educational development of special needs children. Los Niños has been a Best Company to Work For in New York award winner in multiple recent years. I met some of Scott's employees and recognized that he'd assembled a pretty elite team. Still, Scott has his frustrations. I'm babysitting too much. Some folks take care of stuff, they own it, grow it, love it, and have great results. Others need reminders. Maybe they don't do the killer follow-up, or they have other needs. He is not alone. A recent survey indicated that 44% of business leaders reported their disappointment in the performance of their employees. This vexation within both parties in the workplace has one root cause, our present leadership model, which is a painfully outdated one. The problem, leader-follower. When I served in the U.S. Navy, I had firsthand experience with an outdated leadership model. Here's what my Naval Academy leadership book told me about being a leader. Leadership is the art, science, or gift by which a person is enabled and privileged to direct the thoughts, plans, and actions of others in such a manner as to obtain and command their obedience, their confidence, their respect, and their loyal cooperation. In other words, leadership in the Navy and in most organizations is about controlling people. It divides the world into two groups of people, leaders and followers. Most of what we study, learn, and practice in terms of leadership today follows this leader-follower structure. This model has been with us for a long time. It is pervasive. It is the structure depicted in the Iliad, in Beowulf, and in other Western epics. It permeates some of the most popular novels and movies about leadership, such as Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander. People can accomplish a tremendous amount through the leader-follower model, particularly with adept bosses. The widespread development of farming, the pyramids in Egypt, and the factories of the Industrial Revolution were all built using this structure. It generated tremendous wealth. Many bosses and owners got rich, and the followers were better off too. It is exactly because the leader-follower way of doing business has been so successful that it is both so appealing and so hard to give up. But this model developed during a period when mankind's primary work was physical. Consequently, it's optimized for extracting physical work from humans. In our modern world, the most important work we do is cognitive. So it's not surprising that a structure developed for physical work isn't optimal for intellectual work. People who are treated as followers have the expectation of followers and act like followers. As followers, they have limited decision-making authority and little incentive to give the utmost of their intellect, energy, and passion. Those who take orders usually run at half speed, underutilizing their imagination and initiative. While this doesn't matter much for rowing a trireme, it's everything for operating a nuclear-powered submarine. This is a recognized limitation of the leader-follower model. We're taught the solution is empowerment. The problem with empowerment programs is that they contain an inherent contradiction between the message and the method. While the message is empowerment, the method, it takes me to empower you, fundamentally disempowers employees. That drowns out the message. Additionally, in a leader-follower structure, the performance of the organization is closely linked to the ability of the leader. As a result, there is a natural tendency to develop personality-driven leadership. Followers gravitate toward the personality. Short-term performance is rewarded. When leaders who tend to do it all themselves and rely on personality depart, they are missed and performance can change significantly. Psychologically, for the leader, this is tremendously rewarding. It is seductive. Psychologically, for most followers, this is debilitating. The follower learns to rely on the leader to make all the decisions rather than to fully engage with the work process to make the organization run as efficiently as possible. The solution, leader-leader. The leader-leader structure is fundamentally different from the leader-follower structure. At its core is the belief that we can all be leaders, and in fact, it's best when we all are leaders. Leadership is not some mystical quality that some possess and others do not. As humans, we all have what it takes, and we all need to use our leadership abilities in every aspect of our work life. The leader-leader model not only achieves great improvements in effectiveness and morale, but also makes the organization stronger. Most critically, these improvements are enduring, decoupled from the leader's personality and presence. Leader-leader structures are significantly more resilient, and they do not rely on the designated leader always being right. Further, leader-leader structures spawn additional leaders throughout the organization naturally. It can't be stopped. Born of failure. When I reported to my first job as a junior officer on the USS Sunfish, SSN 649, a Sturgeon-class attack submarine, I was technically an expert on all the systems on the ship, including the intimate details of the reactor plant. I have always been an eager learner, and I graduated number one from my nuclear power school class and the submarine officer basic course. Between these advanced courses and my Naval Academy training, I definitely knew a lot about submarines as well as leadership. Technical expertise forms the basis of leadership in the nuclear Navy, and my first captain was an embodiment of that philosophy. Brusque, aloof, but technically expert, he led Sunfish during our first and highly successful deployment. I didn't think twice about how he ran the ship. That was the way things were. Between my first and second deployments on Sunfish, we got a new captain, Commander, later Rear Admiral, Mark Polyath. One day, while we were cruising in the Atlantic Ocean during our training cycle, and nothing much was going on, I saw a large merchant ship through the periscope. Sonar had been listening to it, but they were not sure of its range because they had only been authorized for passive listening, the normal mode for submarines. I whimsically mused with the sonar chief how helpful it would be if they could ping on the merchant using active sonar, something we rarely did. Captain Polyath appeared beside me. "Well, why don't you?" Of course he knew the reason. It takes the captain's permission to authorize going active on sonar. Sensing my discomfort, he said, "Why don't you just say, 'Captain, I intend to go active on sonar for training.'" I tried it. "Captain, I intend to go active on sonar for training." He responded, "Very well," and disappeared, leaving me standing alone and actually in charge for the first time. For the next half hour, we pinged away using all the combinations of pulses we could with our sonar and cycling every sonarman through the sonar shack so they could see what an active surface contact looked like. The sonarmen loved using their equipment in novel ways. The sonar chief loved training his men. I loved it too. That taste of authority and ability to craft my watch team's training was a powerful tonic for me. I looked forward to my time on watch. When off watch, I spent hours studying and dreaming up new ways of training with my watch team. After Sunfish, I served as a flag aide in the Pentagon and went to the Naval Postgraduate School to get a year of Russian language training and a master's degree in national security affairs. After this respite, it was back to sea as the engineer on board the USS Will Rogers, SSBN 659, from 1989 to 1991. I thought I knew something about leadership. Turned out I didn't. My tour on the Will Rogers was a disaster. We were in a dispiriting top-down leadership environment. No one wanted to be there. To change that, I intended to get the crew more involved and to decentralize decision-making. I used all the tricks I had learned to inspire and empower my team, but none of those tricks seemed to improve either performance or morale. In fact, we ended up having a lot more problems. I just couldn't figure out what was going wrong. I felt like Ian and wanted to quit. After a while, I reverted to taking back the authority I had tried to share, micromanaging projects and controlling every decision possible. 8 years after departing Will Rogers, when I took command of the USS Santa Fe, SSN 763, one of the most modern nuclear-powered attack submarines, that experience weighed heavily on me. The problems I encountered on Santa Fe reminded me of those I faced on Will Rogers. They were all fundamentally about people and leadership. I was resolved to try a new leadership approach. Success, immediately and forever. A nuclear-powered submarine is an unlikely place for a leadership revolution to occur. It operates in an unforgiving environment. Deadlines are tight, as is space. When no one is ever farther than 150 feet away from the control room, it's easy to adopt a highly hierarchical management structure. Naval tradition and the approach of the Naval Nuclear Power Program, which stresses accountability and technical competence, reinforce that natural accretion of power, authority, and control at the top. Submarines, which can operate for extended periods without radio communication, are the closest things we have to the far-ranging frigates of old. In short, they offer the perfect environment for reinforcing leader-follower. When I took command of Santa Fe, its crew were at the bottom of the fleet, technically, operationally, and emotionally. Within a year, the situation was totally turned around. We went from worst to first in most measures of performance, including the one I valued most, our ability to retain our sailors and officers. The steps were evolutionary. The result was revolutionary. Santa Fe performed superbly while I served as its captain. If that had been it, this would be the same personality-driven leadership story that occupies so much space on bookshelves now. Only 10 years later can we assess the true success of that work, with Santa Fe's continued operational excellence and the implausibly high promotion rates for its officers and crew. This is the legacy of Leader Leader. Turn the Ship Around is the story of that journey and the men aboard Santa Fe who lived it with me. It describes essentially four phases in my struggle to change the way we interacted for the better. I describe how I needed to let go of old ideas to make room for the new ones in part one. In parts two, three, and four, I describe the bridge to Leader Leader and supporting pillars. The bridge is control, divesting control to others in your organization while keeping responsibility. Control, we discovered, only works with a competent workforce that understands the organization's purpose. Hence, as control is divested, both technical competence and organizational clarity need to be strengthened. The book parts are generally grouped into these categories, but the reality of how this works is that these cycles are repeated in ever-increasing circles. I imagine a world where we all find satisfaction in our work. It is a world where every human being is intellectually engaged, motivated, and self-inspired. Our cognitive capacity as a race is fully engaged in solving the monumental problems that we face. Ultimately, this book is a call to action, a manifesto for all those frustrated workers and bosses for whom the current leadership structure just isn't working. We need to reject leader-follower as a model and view the world as a place for leaders everywhere to achieve this vision. Whether you are a boss, an employee, a teacher, or a parent, you will find ways to work toward this goal. Have fun, and let me know how Leader Leader works for you. Send me your stories and thoughts at david@turntheshiparound.com. Cast of characters. Captain Mark Kenny, prospective commanding officer, instructor, and later Commodore, Submarine Squadron 7, to which the USS Santa Fe was assigned. Lieutenant Commander Tom Stanley, executive officer on Santa Fe, 1999 to 2000. Lieutenant Commander Mike Bernacki, executive officer on Santa Fe, 2000 to 2002. Lieutenant Commander Rick Panlilio, engineer on Santa Fe, 1998 to 2001. Lieutenant Commander Bill Green, navigator on Santa Fe, 1997 to 1999. Lieutenant Dave Adams, weapons officer on Santa Fe, 1998 to 2001. Lieutenant Caleb Kerr, navigator on Santa Fe, 2000 to 2004. Senior Chief Andy Warshak, Chief Sonderman and Weapons Department Chief on Santa Fe, 1998 to 2002. Chief David Steele, Chief Fire Controlman on Santa Fe, 1996 to 2000. Chief Brad Jensen, Senior Nuclear Chief Bull Nuke on Santa Fe, 1998 to 2000. Chief Mike Seco, Senior Nuclear Chief Bull Nuke on Santa Fe, 2000 to 2002. YN2 Scott Dillon, Yeoman Division Leader on Santa Fe, 1998 to 2001. Sled Dog, Quartermaster, Navigation Plotter on Santa Fe, 1998 to 2001. Part 1. Starting Over. Our greatest struggle is within ourselves. Whatever sense we have of thinking we know something is a barrier to continued learning. For me, my ideas of leadership were formed by reading Western classics like Beowulf and The Odyssey, reading histories of the sea, and watching popular movies. These notions of leader as individual hero were strongly reinforced when I got to the U.S. Naval Academy. In this part of the book, I describe my frustration, questioning, and ultimate rejection of that type of leadership. I didn't realize it at the time, but the assumption behind that leadership structure, so fundamental that it becomes subconscious, is that there are leaders and there are followers. It was only after I cleared my mind of these preconceptions that I was able to truly see a better way for humans to interact. Chapter 1, Pain. How has failure shaped you? As a department head, I tried to implement a new leadership approach on Will Rogers and failed. 1989, the Irish Sea. 8,000 tons of steel moved silently, hidden in the depths of the Irish Sea. In the control room of the USS Will Rogers, SSBN 659, the officer of the deck ordered the ship toward the wider, deeper expanses of the North Atlantic. Glancing at the missile control panel, he could see the status of the 16 Poseidon missiles on board, each capable of carrying 14 multiple nuclear-armed reentry vehicles. These missiles were the sole reason for the existence of the Will Rogers, a nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarine, SSBN for short, the kind of submarine the crew affectionately called a boomer. One thing above all else mattered for a boomer: to be at sea and in a condition that would enable it to execute a strike if so ordered. SSBNs were a vital component of America's strategic deterrent. The control room was the nerve center of the ship. So important were its 16 missiles, invulnerable to attack once underway and submerged, that boomers had two crews, a blue crew and a gold crew, to maximize the time the submarine could spend at sea on strategic deterrent patrol. The crews lived near New London, Connecticut, and Will Rogers was operated out of a forward base at Holyrock, Scotland. Every 3 months, the crews would swap with a 3-day turnover period. After assuming the boat from the other crew, the new crew would spend 4 weeks doing the necessary corrective and preventive maintenance before going to sea. In order for the United States to have a credible strategic deterrent, the missiles needed to be ready to go. If Will Rogers couldn't make it on time, another submarine would have to remain at sea longer. 41 of these ballistic missile submarines were built between 1958 and 1965 in response to the Soviet threat, an impressive industrial accomplishment. Will Rogers was the last of the 41 SSBNs and had operated nearly continuously since its commissioning. Those original submarines were being replaced by the newer and more capable Ohio class. However, Will Rogers still had important operational tasking to perform. Nevertheless, after 33 years, it was a tired ship. Worse, during the patrol before I reported aboard, Will Rogers had collided with a trawler and failed an important certification. I checked the chart in the control room. We were on track to start the deep dive in about half an hour. I walked aft, past the rows of missile tubes and the reactor compartment, to the engine room. With my flashlight, I started doing a last-minute walkabout. All the repairs have been properly certified as completed, but it wouldn't hurt to do one more visual check. As engineer officer for the Blue Crew, I was responsible for inspecting the nuclear reactor and the important auxiliary equipment and supervising the 60 men who maintained and operated it. There was a constant tension between doing things right and meeting deadlines. Every member of the crew felt it. The job was grueling, and I wasn't particularly happy with how things were going. The officer I relieved was very involved in details. He was always reviewing technical documents and directing maintenance and other operations. I was determined to change that by giving the men more control of their work, more decision-making authority, and fewer lists of tasks. In doing so, I hoped to bring the passion I'd experienced on Sunfish to Will Rogers. In this, I was going against the tide. Just prior to going aboard, I'd had the chance to ride another SSBN for several days. It was undergoing an underway warfighting inspection, and the crew were tasked with different missions that required significant internal coordination. I followed the captain around to see what he did. He was everywhere, dashing to the engine room, then back to control, running to sonar, and from there to the torpedo room. I was exhausted before 24 hours were over. I'm not sure he ever slept during the 3 days I was observing. That ship did well on its inspection, and the inspection team specifically cited the involvement of the captain. I had a sense of unease because I knew that wasn't how I wanted to run a submarine. Even if it were, I knew I could not physically do what he did. Even though the Navy encouraged this kind of top-down leadership, I pressed forward with my Sunfish-inspired plan to give control to the department rather than orders. For example, rather than giving specific lists of tasks to the division officers and chiefs aboard the Will Rogers, I gave broad guidance and told them to prepare the task lists and present the lists to me. Rather than telling everyone what we needed to do, I would ask questions about how they thought we should approach a problem. Rather than being the central hub coordinating maintenance between two divisions, I told the division chiefs to talk to each other directly. Things did not go well. During the maintenance period, we made several errors that required us to redo work. We fell behind schedule. We also had several jobs that didn't start on time because the mid-level management had not assembled all the parts and permissions or established the propulsion plant conditions necessary to do the work. I overheard people wishing for the old engineer back, who would just tell them what to do. Indeed, it would have been much faster just to tell people what to do, and I frequently found myself barking out a list of orders just to get the work done. I wasn't happy with myself, but no one else seemed to mind much. I seemed to be the only one who wanted a more democratic and empowered workplace, and I wondered if I was on the right track. It was touch and go, but as the maintenance period came to an end, my efforts to empower others seemed to be working. There was a budding sense of optimism. We'd make it on time. In a moment, I realized we wouldn't. I dropped down the ladder into the lower level of the engine room. I was scanning the various pieces of equipment with my flashlight, and I was stopped cold by what I saw. The nuts holding the bolts for the end bell of a large seawater heat exchanger had been improperly installed. The nuts weren't sufficiently grabbing the threads on the bolts. They were close, but I was sure they didn't meet the technical specification. Someone had taken a shortcut. This cooler was subjected to full submergence pressure. Even a small leak would cause seawater to spray into the ship with tremendous force. Failure would be catastrophic. My heart sank. The deep dive should be starting shortly. I needed to cancel that immediately. Not only would we need to reassemble this cooler, we would need to inspect all the other coolers to make sure the mistake hadn't been repeated. Most important of all, we would need to figure out how this had happened. I called the officer of the deck and told him we'd need to postpone the deep dive. Then I started the long walk forward to tell the captain. Walking past the 16 tubes in the missile compartment, I felt quite alone. The reputation of the ship and my department would suffer. My efforts at empowering my team had failed. This should never have happened. As expected, the captain had a fit. Of course, that didn't help fix the problem. After this, things got worse. I had wanted to give my team more authority and control, but my heart wasn't in it anymore. I would give decision-making control to my people, but they'd make bad decisions. If I was going to get yelled at least wanted it to be my fault. I went back to leading in the old way I'd been taught. I personally briefed every event. I approved all decisions myself. I set up systems where reports came to me all day and all night. I never slept well because messengers were waking me up so I could make decisions. I was exhausted and miserable. The men in the department weren't happy either, but they stoically went about their jobs. I prevented any more major problems, but everything hinged on me. Numerous times I found errors. Far from being proud of catching these mistakes, I lamented my indispensability and worried what would happen when I was tired, asleep, or wrong. I assessed my chances of being selected for executive officer, my next career milestone, as low. None of the other department heads on the Will Rogers were selected, screened, for executive officer. None of the department heads on the Gold Crew screened either. Neither executive officer screened for captain. The captain wasn't promoted. The Will Rogers was a cemetery for careers. I made plans to do something else with my life. I took a job doing START and INF treaty inspections in the former Soviet Union with the on-site inspection agency instead of going to a submarine staff job. I returned from an inspection in Volgograd to find a message in my inbox. I had been screened for executive officer the next step after my tour as the engineering department head. I would be going back to sea in a submarine. I should have been ecstatic. Executive officer was one step below captain. Instead, I was strangely ambivalent. I would have to grapple with the tension between how I aspired to be a leader and how I actually was. Thinking anew. While assigned to the on-site inspection agency, I had to contemplate what had happened on the Will Rogers. I started reading everything I could about leadership, management, psychology, communication, motivation, and human behavior. I thought deeply about what motivated me and how I wanted to be treated. I remembered the release of energy, passion, and creativity I had experienced running my own watch team on the Sunfish. I was motivated to avoid any reoccurrence of the pain, frustration, and emptiness of my 3 years on the Will Rogers, both being directed and directing others. At the end of that study, I was troubled by three contradictions. First, though I liked the idea of empowerment, I didn't understand why empowerment was needed. It seemed to me that humans are born in a state of action and natural empowerment. After all, it wasn't likely that a species that was naturally passive could have taken over the planet. Empowerment programs appeared to be a reaction to the fact that we had actively disempowered people. Additionally, it seemed inherently contradictory to have an empowerment program whereby I would empower my subordinates and my boss would empower me. I felt my power came from within, and attempts to empower me felt like manipulation. Second, the way I was told to manage others was not the way I wanted to be managed. I felt I was at my best when given specific goals, but broad latitude in how to accomplish them. I didn't respond well to executing a bunch of tasks. In fact, being treated that way irritated me and caused me to shut my brain down. That was intellectually wasteful and unfulfilling. Third, I was disturbed by the close coupling of the technical competence of the leader with the performance of the organization. Ships with a good commanding officer did well, as had the SSBN I rode. Ships that didn't have a good commanding officer didn't do well, but a ship could become a bad ship overnight when a new CO came aboard. And there was a further twist. Every so often a mishap occurred that caused people to shake their heads and lament. It happened on such a good ship. It seems the captain had made a mistake and the crew, lemming-like, just followed him. I concluded that competence could not rest solely with the leader. It had to run throughout the entire organization. Essentially, what I've been trying to achieve on Will Rogers was to run an empowerment program within a leader-follower structure. The leadership structure, which was strongly reinforced by the behavior and expectations of the captain, was one of do what you are told. Hence, my efforts amounted to little more than do what you are told, but It just didn't work. What I was trying to do was an extension of the way things worked on Sunfish. On that ship, I was empowered, but the sense of leadership stopped with me. Those in my watch team were followers in the traditional model. What made it so liberating was that, for those 6 hours, I didn't feel like a follower. That's what I had wanted to pass on to the officers and crew of the Will Rogers Engineering Department. One of the things that limits our learning is our belief that we already know something. My experience on the Will Rogers convinced me there was something fundamentally wrong with our approach. Simply exhorting people to be proactive, take ownership, be involved, and all the other aspects of an empowerment program just scratched the surface. It was only after serving on the Will Rogers that I opened myself up to new ideas about leadership. I began to seriously question the image of the sea captain as master and commander. I began to wonder whether everything I'd been taught about leadership was wrong. Questions to consider. Why do we need empowerment? Do you need someone else to empower you? How reliant is your organization on the decision-making of one person or a small group of people? What kind of leadership model does your business or organization use? When you think of movie images that depict leadership, who and what comes to mind? What assumptions are embedded in those images? How do these images influence how you think about yourself as a leader? To what extent do these images limit your growth as a leader? Chapter 2, Business as Usual. Are you and your people working to optimize the organization for their tenure or forever? To promote long-term success, I had to ignore the short-term reward systems. December 1998, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The USS Olympia, SSN 717, was heading out the main Pearl Harbor channel without me. I hadn't expected that. I'd been training for 12 months to take command of this specific submarine, and my change of command was in less than 4 weeks. It was a dream assignment. Olympia was a frontline SSN, a nuclear-powered attack submarine, exactly what I'd hoped for. While Will Rogers' mission was to hide in the vastness of the ocean, attack boats were the hunters and would take the fight to the enemy. I had studied the equipment configuration and piping diagrams, the exact reactor plant, the schedule, the weapons, and every problem report the ship had issued in the previous 3 years. I learned the career status of each officer and read his biography. I reviewed every inspection report. Tactical inspections, reactor inspections, safety inspections, food service inspections. For a year, I'd been doing nothing but think about the sailors on Olympia and my responsibility to lead them for the next 3 years. In the way of the nuclear navy, I had gained an intimate technical knowledge of the ship. I had loved the prospective commanding officer training I had just completed. I was responsible only for myself for an entire year. In addition to the specifics of Olympia, we learned tactics and leadership. I attended a week-long leadership school in Newport, Rhode Island, and my wife, Jane, had been able to join me. The entire training course culminated with an intense 2-week period at sea, driving submarines hard and shooting torpedoes. The officers leading prospective commanding officer training were hand-selected from among proven captains. Captain Mark Kenny, who had commanded the Los Angeles-class submarine USS Birmingham, SSN 698, led my group. Mark inspired us to great learning as well as introspection. Every day we learned about our submarines and ourselves. During one torpedo approach, I devised an elaborate ruse that would flush out the opposing submarine and make it a sitting duck for our attack. I predicted to the officers in the control room, in this case, other prospective commanding officers, what would happen. The situation developed exactly as I'd foreseen, and we were able to get a hit on a quiet and tenacious enemy. In the middle of the attack, however, I'd had to reach over and do the job of one of the other prospective commanding officers because he'd gotten confused. I thought I was brilliant, but Captain Kenny took me aside and upbraided me. It didn't matter how smart my plan was if the team couldn't execute it. It was a lesson that would serve me well. Olympia was doing well. Its retention numbers were good, and its inspection scores were above average. Operationally, It had a reputation on the waterfront for getting it done, that is, fulfilling the missions assigned to it. I wondered what kind of a leadership approach I'd want to apply aboard Olympia. I was keen to get aboard this workhorse of the fleet and finish the turnover process. During the month I was to spend on board before taking command, the ship would be in port for a maintenance period except for this 2-day evaluation of the ship's ability to operate the reactor plant. Accordingly, I arranged to ride with the inspection team to meet the Olympia at the entrance to Pearl Harbor. This would not only be my only opportunity to see the ship and crew operate at sea before taking command, it would also be tremendously useful for me to watch the ship go through the inspection. I would be without the emotional attachment of being part of the crew, but I would be responsible for carrying out any corrective action after I took over. As Olympia appeared in the channel and approached the turning basin, the radios crackled on the small boat. The coxswain reported the passengers he expected to transfer to Oley. And then word came back from the Olympia. Only the inspection team would come aboard, not the prospective commanding officer. I wasn't allowed on board. I must have misunderstood the plan. I watched as the submarine turned around and the small boat came alongside, put the bow across, and transferred the inspection team to Oley. I could see the captain on the bridge, but we never made eye contact. Then the bow was raised, and Oley returned to sea. The small boat carried me back to the inner harbor and dropped me off. I was miffed that the captain didn't want me aboard. He was depriving me of seeing the boat operate and watching the inspection. In less than a month, I was going to be totally accountable for the performance of this submarine, but wouldn't be able to see it underway. Yet, at one level, who could blame him? I would take up another bunk and inconvenience a crew member. Even though this 2-day underway period at sea would be greatly useful in sustaining Olympia's quality performance after he departed, he apparently had no interest in helping facilitate that. Could I fault him? In the Navy system, captains are graded on how well their ships perform up to the day they depart, not a day longer. After that, it becomes someone else's problem. I thought about that. On every submarine and ship, and in every squadron and battalion, hundreds of captains were making thousands of decisions to optimize the performance of their commands for their tour and their tour alone. If they did anything for the long run, it was because of an enlightened sense of duty, not because there was anything in the system that rewarded them for it. We didn't associate an officer's leadership effectiveness with how well his unit performed after he left. We didn't associate an officer's leadership effectiveness with how often his people got promoted 2, 3, or 4 years hence. We didn't even track that kind of information. All that mattered was performance in the moment. Nothing to see here. Move along. I did get aboard Olympia 3 days later when it was tied to the pier. As expected, it had done well on its inspection. My turnover on Olympia was straightforward. A review of the records, material inspections, and interviews with the officers and crew. As I walked about the ship, I noted that the crew seemed alert and confident. Almost too confident, actually. Because I had a detailed knowledge of the ship, the systems, and the trouble reports, I was able to pinpoint technical issues I wanted to explore. I asked lots of questions about why we did things certain ways. The crew's answers were concise and certain. I soon realized there wasn't any impetus for change. Oley was operating in a top-down, business-as-usual structure, and everyone liked it that way. I thought about how I would lead the ship when I took over. I shelved my ideas for a radical management change because there would be too much internal resistance. The crew, doing well, wouldn't see the need. I was resigned to executing incremental changes on the standard hierarchical structure. It is precisely the success of the top-down leader-follower structure that makes it so appealing. As long as you are measuring performance over just the short run, it can be effective. Officers are rewarded for being indispensable, for being missed after they depart. When the performance of a unit goes down after an officer leaves, it is taken as a sign that he was a good leader, not that he was ineffective in training his people properly. Another factor that makes this leadership approach appealing is the induced numbness. It absolves subordinates of the hard work of thinking, making decisions, and being responsible and accountable. You are just a cog, an executor of the decisions of others. Hey, I was only doing what I was told. People get comfortable with this. There's a cost to the people, though, which only becomes evident over time. People who are treated as followers treat others as followers when it's their turn to lead. A vast, untapped human potential is lost as a result of treating people as followers. Only in the long run, 3 to 10 years later, does it become obvious. But by that time, people have moved on to new jobs. With Olympia sitting pierside, I sped through my program reviews, inspections, and interviews. Already a technical expert on the ship, I got bored with the turnover and decided to take a week's vacation with my wife. There was a venerable cruise ship, the SS Independence, that cruised around the Hawaiian Islands, and we decided to spend the last week before the change of command on a cruise. The first 4 days were pretty relaxing, observing the beauty of the islands. I was comfortable with how Oli was operating, and the leadership was going to be right up my alley, the same kind that had gotten me through Will Rogers. On the fifth morning, while our cruise ship was passing the lava flowing into the ocean from Kilauea, I received a phone call. In those days, it was unusual to receive a call from shore, and I assumed it was an internal call. I was startled to hear a crackly voice on the other end inform me that my change of command was canceled. I had to be taking over the Santa Fe instead, just after New Year's. I was panicked. The foundation of my leadership approach, my technical competence, was for the wrong submarine. Questions to consider. In your organization, are people rewarded for what happens after they transfer? Are they rewarded for the success of their people? Do people want to be missed after they leave? When an organization does worse immediately after the departure of a leader, what does this say about that person's leadership? How does the organization view this situation? How does the perspective of time horizon affect our leadership actions? What can we do to incentivize long-term thinking? Chapter 3, Change of Course. What's your level of commitment? I discovered that the hardest thing about my planned turnaround project was my own fortitude. December 1998, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The first thing I did when we returned from our cruise was to visit my new boss and former prospective commanding officer instructor, Commodore Mark Kenny. Instead of heading down to the submarine piers to continue my turnover on Olympia, I veered into the building that had housed the Pacific Fleet Commander's office during the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, the Navy's three Pearl Harbor submarine commanders have their offices in that building. I was literally taking a new turn. The Olympia was in Squadron 3, and Santa Fe was in Squadron 7. My mentor from prospective commanding officer training, Commodore Mark Kenny, had just taken over Squadron 7, so he was going to be my new boss. Mark had argued forcefully for me to be assigned the job of turning Santa Fe around. He had credibility because he'd be living with his recommendation. It was the reason I got the job. Later, Mark told me that one of the reasons he argued for me was that I'd evinced a particular enthusiasm for learning throughout the entire prospective commanding officer course. He sensed that a keen curiosity would be vital for the successful about-face of Santa Fe and its crew, a fact I would later deeply appreciate in ways I didn't then imagine. When I got the news that I would be taking command of Santa Fe, it was a shock. I didn't know much about Santa Fe, other than it was stationed in Pearl Harbor and scheduled to deploy in 6 months. In contrast to the Olympia, Santa Fe was the ship we all joked about during the prospective commanding officer training pipeline. A damning photograph of Santa Fe's inattentive crewmen had been released on the internet the previous year. It earned the captain a scolding and was used as a training example of how not to be. Santa Fe was the ship that had trouble getting underway on time, and Santa Fe had the worst retention in the submarine force. In 1998, for example, it reenlisted only 3 crew members. Mark discussed my new job. You need to get Santa Fe and your crew ready for deployment in 6 months. It's a dream deployment from an operational perspective with the Constellation Battle Group, but it's going to be demanding. One of the things we're going to try and set up is a torpedo exercise in the shallow Arabian Gulf to demonstrate our combat effectiveness. What Mark said next didn't present a pretty sight. I'm not going to minimize the task in front of you. The ship isn't doing well. It looks from here like there's a leadership vacuum. This is a unique situation. In all my time on the waterfront, I can't remember such a particular confluence of events. Look, here's the deal. If you need to change out some people, let me know. But I'm not interested in a lot of turnover. I don't think that will help the crew. I think a better focus would be on working with what you've got. With only 6 months to deployment, you don't have a lot of time to find replacements. I was thinking that too. In the end, I fired no one. This was important because it sent the message to each crew member that he wasn't screwed up. The leadership was. My challenge would be to use the same people and support team, and by changing the way they interacted and behaved, dramatically increase the combat effectiveness of Santa Fe. This was important because it sent the message to each crew member that he wasn't screwed up, the leadership was. My challenge would be to use the same people and support team, and by changing the way they interacted and behaved, dramatically increase the combat effectiveness of Santa Fe. As the captain, I would be assisted by an executive officer, the second in command, who was qualified to take command in case I became incapacitated. There would be the four department heads, weapons, engineering, navigation operations, and supply. Each department head except the supply officer, SUPO, would be trained in nuclear power and could aspire to command his own submarine someday. The odds were, however, that only one of the three officers would. The jury was out on these men. Mark explained that the executive officer seemed to be closely identified with the outgoing captain, and two of the department heads were too new to assess. "Look, you've got 100% from me and my squadron staff," Mark continued, "to help you get the ship ready. We aren't going to walk down there and tell you what you need, but whatever you think you need, we'll support." We also talked about the junior officers. As a group, they were ignored, untrained, and not staying in the Navy. Because this was their first tour, these men were probably the most neglected group on board. All they'd known about submarining and how to be an officer, other than academically, was based on Santa Fe. They were a mix. About half had graduated from the Naval Academy, and about half came out of Naval ROTC. We talked about Santa Fe chiefs. Unempowered, uninspired. The 12 chiefs are the senior enlisted men. They are middle management. At our submarine schools, the instructors tell us that officers make sure we do the right things, and chiefs make sure we do things right. Their technical expertise and leadership would be key, as would my ability to tap their expertise. Just as underway time on patrol was the reason the nation built SSBNs, deployments were the reason the nation built SSNs. Deployments were a period of operating for 6 months away from home port. During that time, we'd be mostly submerged, operating in areas where our potential adversaries might operate. We'd surface and make port calls to resupply and conduct minor repairs. But overall, we'd need to travel 30,000 miles on our own. Submarines were most useful forward, in hostile waters, and not sitting back under the protection of the carrier battle group or other allied forces. Deployments required the ship and crew to be at peak maintenance, training, manning, and supply conditions. The Commodore explained that there weren't going to be any breaks in the schedule to accommodate the abrupt change in captain. The Navy and Nation needed Santa Fe to be a full-up round, that is, a fully capable submarine. Mark would have the final say on whether my submarine was ready to deploy. His parting words of encouragement: "I have great confidence in your ability to do this. And just one piece of advice, you might want to get a good flashlight." We shook hands and I headed down to the boat. How was I going to do this? I wasn't sure it was a possible task. I felt overwhelmed and didn't know where to start. Preparing for deployment was daunting enough, let alone with a demoralized crew, Was I willing to risk implementing a new leadership approach as well? Upon reflection, Commodore Kenny was providing great leadership. He provided me with a specific goal, have Santa Fe ready for deployment in every way, but did not tell me how to do it. The other thing he was telling me was that the people and resources available to the ship would be the same as they were before and the same as they were to any other submarine. Consequently, the only thing we could change was how we acted and interacted. This would be my focus. Then I began to reconsider the situation. Since Mark wasn't going to micromanage me, maybe this was the chance to do something different. Maybe this was the chance to set the crew free from the top-down, do-what-you're-told approach to leadership. Maybe this was the opportunity of a lifetime. Of course, I would be solely responsible, and if Santa Fe wasn't ready, it would be my fault and likely my job. I resolved to give it a try. I left his office and headed down to the pier where Santa Fe was berthed. Questions to consider. What are you willing to personally risk? Sometimes taking a step for the better requires caring, not caring. Caring deeply about the people and mission, but not caring about the bureaucratic consequences to your personal career. What must leaders overcome mentally and emotionally to give up control yet fully retain responsibility? What's the hardest thing you experience in letting go of micromanaging, top-down leadership, or the cult of personality? How can you get your project teams interacting differently, but still use the same resources? What can you as a subordinate do to get your boss to let you try a new way of handling a project? Do you give employees specific goals as well as the freedom to meet them in any way they choose? Chapter 4. Frustration. Are you curious? I thought I was being curious during my previous tours. Turns out I was only questioning. December 15, 1998. On board USS Santa Fe, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. 25 days to change of command. I approached Santa Fe with a mix of curiosity and anxiety. In the U.S. Navy, we named the submarine classes after the hull number of the first ship in the class. The Los Angeles-class submarines are 688s, and the class was split into two flights, first flight and second flight. The Olympia is the 30th ship of the first flight 688s. Santa Fe is a second flight 688. Other than the overall hull shape, the ships are significantly different. The first flight 688s have sail planes, four torpedo tubes, and a reactor plant that needs to be refueled once during the life of the ship. The second flight 688s have bow planes, 12 vertical launch Tomahawk land attack missile, TLAM, tubes, in addition to the four torpedo tubes, and a redesigned reactor plant that is enough fuel to last the entire life of the ship. I descended the narrow hatch. As I passed through the mess decks, I heard the topside watch announcing, "Commander, United States Navy arriving, per protocol." I made my way forward through the narrow passageways. I pleasantly greeted each crew member I passed. The passageways in a submarine are about 2 feet wide. You can't pass someone without acknowledging their presence. It's just like passing someone in the aisle of an airplane. Mostly I got mumbles or grunts, and a lot of men looking down at their shoes. They seemed embarrassed. They avoided eye contact. They avoided conversing. These guys were beaten. They had been told over and over they were the worst ship in the submarine force, and they believed it. Just across the water from the Olympia, it was worlds away. I stopped by the captain's stateroom to let him know I was on board. I was his relief, and in a couple weeks this would be my responsibility, but right now it was his. That was a bit awkward, since he would be leaving command a year early. Eventually, I would be assigned the second desk in the XO's stateroom for my base of operations. But for the moment, I didn't have a place. The change in orders had caught the crew of Santa Fe by surprise, too. Not having a place to plop down, I walked into the control room and looked around instead. The equipment was shut down, but I could see from the panel faces, gauges, and dials that it was different from what I'd seen before. Since I didn't have a place, I started wandering around the ship. After a time, I started asking nearby crew members about the various pieces of equipment. For the first time, I was truly curious. Walking the ship, I would ask the crew questions about their equipment and what they were working on. They were skeptical about these questions initially. That's because normally I would have been questioning, not curious. I would have been asking questions to make sure they knew the equipment. Now I was asking questions to make sure I knew the equipment. My unfamiliarity with the sub's technical details was having an interesting side effect. Since I couldn't get involved with the specifics of the gear, I opened up space to focus on the people and their interactions instead, and to rely on the crew more than I normally would have. I decided I'd do physical inspections of the ship and review the records, but only as a guise for understanding the crew. Whereas on Oley, I had reviewed some records by myself, I decided that everything I did on Santa Fe would be with an officer, a chief, or a crew member. I started interviewing the chiefs and officers in their spaces. After having them tell me about their people, I asked them a loosely structured set of questions like these. What are the things you are hoping I don't change? What are the things you secretly hope I do change? What are the good things about Santa Fe we should build on? If you were me, what would you do first? Why isn't the ship doing better? What are your personal goals for your tour here on Santa Fe? What impediments do you have doing your job? What will be our biggest challenge getting Santa Fe ready for deployment? What are your biggest frustrations about how Santa Fe is currently run? What's the best thing I can do for you? Later, I thought about some of the things I had heard. A lot of things were problems with how Santa Fe did business. Admin disappears into a black hole. The duty officers delay getting maintenance started. The junior officers are the source of low standards. I was previously qualified for this watch station, transferred ship to ship, and now have to start over with a blank qualification card. I've been waiting for 4 weeks to get a test so that I can qualify. There's no participation in the Wives Club. The radio installation and upgrade we just received left us with less capability than what we had before. I was promised a certain job when I came here, and it hasn't happened. I just keep my head down and try and stay out of trouble. When things go badly, I secretly hope someone else will screw up next. The conversation I had with Fire Control Technician Chief David Steele was typical. I've asked to be transferred, he admitted. Chief Steele had been on board Santa Fe for 2 years and wasn't having fun. He wasn't one of the command's favorites and wasn't moving up the performance rankings. A high school dropout, Steele had gone to see the Navy recruiter when he turned 18. He performed well enough on the aptitude test to be selected for submarines, so the recruiter convinced him to take the GED and enlist. Now, Steele ran the fire control system that sent targeting instructions to every missile and torpedo Santa Fe launched. I still haven't even signed my evaluation, he told me. I resisted the urge to comment on what a disservice this was to him. December already, and the evaluations were due on September 15th. His file would be incomplete when the promotion board met, reducing his chances to zero. I wondered, if the chief's evaluations are this bad, what about the junior enlisted men? And I don't like how the command is handling evals anyway, Chief Steele grumbled. His tell-it-like-it-is style may have grated on some, but I appreciated it. He was key to the Santa Fe's combat effectiveness, and his knowledge of the vertical launch missile system was especially important for me. Look, Chief, I can't promise I'll make you an EP, but I can promise that performance rankings are going to be based on your contribution to the ship's mission, period. EP is the highest competitive ranking. It stands for Early Promote. On another occasion, the chief responsible for a nuclear division told me, "No one has reviewed my equipment status log since I've been here. The equipment status log is a large database that includes details about everything that's wrong with each piece of equipment the division owns, and therefore forms the basis of the maintenance and operational plans." I was uneasy not being the technical expert on each and every piece of equipment on board. The impact of this focus on people was that I was going to have to rely on the crew to provide me with the technical details about how the submarine worked. This went against every grain of my naval leadership and scientific training, but the circumstances demanded a new mode of operation. Doing the same thing as everyone else and hoping for a different outcome didn't make sense. I am not advocating being ignorant about the equipment. For me, however, it was a necessary step to make me truly curious and reliant upon the crew in a way I wouldn't have been without it. Later in my tour, I became a technical expert on all aspects of the Santa Fe, but the positive patterns had been set, and I continued in the same relationship with the crew. If you walk about your organization talking to people, I'd suggest that you be as curious as possible. As with a good dinner table conversation, one question should naturally lead to another. The time to be questioning or even critical is after trust has been established. Questions to consider. Are you asking questions to make sure you know or to make sure they know? Do you have to be the smartest person in your organization? To what degree does technical competence form the basis for leadership? Is that technical competence a personal competence or an organizational competence? How do you know what is going on at the deck plate in your organization?